So our session today is called Seven Life Lessons from Psychological Science, How to Achieve a Sustainable Injury-Free Workplace. And our presenter today is very distinguished, and he has been presenting at the National Safety Council on and off since 1996. E. Scott Geller is the senior partner of Safety Performance Solutions. He is an alumni distinguished professor and director of the Center for Applied Behavior Systems at Virginia Tech down in Blacksburg, Virginia. He's authored many books, training manuals, magazines, research articles addressing behavioral change. He's also a fellow of the American Psychological Association and the Association of Psychological Science. He is also known with the World Academy of Productivity and Quality Sciences. He has received a Lifetime Achievement Award with the American Psychological Foundation and also the International Organizational Network. So let's give him a round of applause. And I introduce to you Mr. E. Scott Geller.
Thank you. Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you for all coming. Last session of the day. Who's tired? Kind of worn out? You've heard a lot? Yeah. And by the way, have you noticed everybody's talking about psychology, right? Everybody's talking about human dynamics. And in fact, I went to a session at noon, a good friend of mine, Jim Spigner, and he owned up to the fact that many people, when they did behavior-based safety, they didn't do it right. And that hurts me, because the first book I wrote was 1996, and we talked about how to do behavior-based safety right. But then I got so kind of disturbed by what's going on out there, so I changed it to people-based safety. And then, today we're calling it actively caring for people. How many never heard me talk before? Wow, how cool is that? How many heard me talk before? 50-50. All right. I'll try to bring something new in. And some folks I know, they've been forever coming to my sessions. And it inspires me. I've been here a long time. I've been studying psychology for over 50 years. I've been a professor at Virginia Tech. This is my 49th year at studying psychology. And everything I'm going to teach you today is research-based, not common sense. You all have your own common sense. I've got my common sense. It's based on our experience, not data. One of my favorite quotes from W. Edwards Deming, I'll show you later. I'll say it right now. In God we trust. All others bring data. Without data, you're a jerk with an opinion. And I'm sad to say I see so much opinion still floating around in the safety world. So I want to teach you seven lessons from psychology. How many had a psychology class? All right. Do you remember back then there was humanism, Carl Rogers, a particular therapeutic approach called humanism. And then, anybody remember B.F. Skinner? That was a behavioral approach. And I've been teaching introductory psychology for 45 years, and all the books are still the same. Dividing these two domains of psychological science. I'm bringing them together. I'm calling it humanistic behaviorism. If behavior-based safety and the consultants who did behavior-based safety had understood the value of being humanistic, it would have all worked so much better. And again, I talked about actively caring in 1996. Notice actively caring. Caring, humanism, active behavior. So it's not enough to care, thank you. We have to act on that caring. So I'm proud to teach you now seven lessons to make the world a better place. How about the songs I played for you? I played Stand By Me. I played Soul to Soul by The Temptations. So then I just played Make This World a Better Place. And I think that's our theme. However, some of you got a CD. Who got a CD? You got a CD? So that CD was created just for us, just for actively caring for people. I wish I could play it, but it's a CD. So I hope you'll play it and listen to it more than once. Hear it more than once. It was produced in Nashville just 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. And I'm bringing it to you. And I wish I have more tomorrow. I didn't realize to be, I didn't have enough. So only raise your hand if you got one. There should be at least 50 or 60 people that, okay. But that's the movement. It's a movement. It's an actively caring for people movement. Sure, it's for safety, but it's beyond. It's more than safety. I am convinced that these seven lessons, if the world knew them and practiced them, human welfare and well-being would increase dramatically beyond safety. So you know what? I want you to hear me as a teacher. No, not me the teacher. You the teacher. I want you to hear me with regard to not understanding these seven lessons. That's not enough. I want you to believe them. That's not enough. I want you to share them. You are an elite group who decided to come last session of the day. Even though this session is repeated tomorrow, you came today. Now, take that responsibility. If you don't believe this, let me know. If you don't understand it, let me know. But I have an hour and a half, 90 minutes. That's a long time to teach you. Just seven. I'm looking at some of you who I know who already know the seven. All right. Oh. Now, I don't understand. High tech, man. That's why I use overheads. Yeah. Huh. I teach introductory psychology, believe it or not, and I use overhead projectors, two on the stage. And the students have never seen them before. They come and say, what's that? Oh, I remember in third grade in Sunday school, I walk between these two overhead projectors, and this is why. I mean, it worked. It worked before.
What's wrong with your room?
Somebody went, yeah, you could. Oh, wait. Is it? Maybe it's this, huh?
It's not working. Okay.
Can you call him? Okay, I don't see them. And okay, yeah, because I'd ask the other lady, but she's a little slow.
I got you.
Yes, sir.
We tried it out when we first
saw it. There we go.
What happened?
Advance.
Oh, yeah.
Backwards. It just took a second to read it.
Okay. All right. So I want to start and talk about the way safety used to be. When I started 45 years ago, I'd sit in audiences like this, and I'd hear about lessons and principles that we have to use, and I held myself back from jumping up and saying, what are you doing? Now, behavior-based safety has made a difference. If some of these things I show you up here, signs with slogans like, this is the way it used to be in safety. Now you tell me for yourself, have we improved? I think we have. Think safety. Safety is a priority. I'm so pleased to have people call it a value. I've been saying this for 40 years. All accidents are preventable. Do we still say that? I must say I heard the word accident used several times today. Please, it's not an accident. The word accident implies you're not in control. Stop with the word accident. All accidents are preventable. That's an oxymoron. It's an oxymoron. If you can't control it, how are you going to prevent it? An accident implies chance, a chance occurrence. Oxymoron, like plastic silverware, like jumbo shrimp, country music, you know, oxymoron. Safety is a condition of employment. We used to say that. We realize now that if you want to engage people, by the way, that's a word I'm hearing a lot today already, you've heard it, we have to get people engaged. It used to be, informed. He used to be trained, but now we have to get him engaged. How does that engage people? Zero accidents is our goal. It's your vision. It's an injury. Zero injury is your vision, and you set goals on things. But see, you all know this. You know this. This is not new to you, right? This is the way it used to be. I'm telling you. Accident investigations. Do you still use that term, accident investigation? How many work with a company that still uses that term? Yeah. And you look for a root cause. Still looking for a root cause? Oh, please, learn something from this conference. Take it back and say, please. You can't find a root cause from a conversation or a survey. You can only find root cause, says a scientist, and I'm a scientist for several years, 50 years. You have to manipulate an independent variable and look at its effect on the dependent variable, and then you have to exclude other possible variables, artifacts that could be influencing a behavior. That's science. You can't find a cause and effect relationship from a conversation. And besides, there's no root cause. There are contributing factors. And your language can make all the difference in the world. Let's look for contributing factors to this injury, or to this close call, or to this minor injury, whatever. There are environmental factors, and there are behavioral factors, and there are person factors, attitudinal factors, but they all. You ask why, how many times you get to the root cause? Huh? Five, right? Five. Are you kidding me? Be skeptical. Be skeptical. You might be a jerk with an opinion. But still do the process. I'm not slamming the process. I'm slamming our language. Safety regulations are passed down from management with no rationale. Used to be that way. Just do it. Why? It's OSHA speaking. It's the way it has to be. The root cause of an injury is identified as someone's behavior. That's why behavior-based safety got into trouble, because people thought that that's what we were talking about. You know, that we're going to blame the worker. It must be his or her behavior. There were consultants not too long ago showing videotapes of people in falling in awkward situations. And then the consultant would ask, what was the cause of that? It was clear behavior, but we have to look beyond behavior. A safety incentive program. I'm telling you, we used to do this. Rewards the work team with the fewest injuries. You know what happens when you do that. We don't report them. And there's peer pressure not to report them. A safe employee of the month program recognizes a worker each month for having the best safety attitude. I'm serious. We used to do that. Thank you very much. Three unsafe behaviors observed, and a worker is sent home for a day without pay. So how many companies still send people home without pay as so-called discipline? Oh, no hands are up. Good. One. Thank you for being honest. Discipline comes from the Latin root to teach, to instruct. It's not punishment. And do you think you send a person home for 3 days, one day without pay, and they come back raring to go, thank you, I needed that. You know it's not. Your common sense even tells you that. And so does psychological science. Workers are penalized after returning to work after a lost time injury. I'm serious. This has changed, but it used to be that way. You come back and people, you ruined our record. Because the best safety company, the safety awards were based on not having an injury. So if you reported an injury, you just ruined our safety award for this year. So we now become failure avoiders. And we don't do much because I might do something and get hurt. At least I don't report when I get hurt. And you know stories of people getting hurt and then putting in with a lost time injury, but they don't send them home. So they don't want to count against their lost time injury record. Can some of you relate to that? Not now, but it used to be. All right, I'm going to start out with my heroes. I got up there, who knows, on the right. On the left is B.F. Skinner. On the right is W. Edwards Deming. And that's where this is coming from. This plus research. Skinner was the behavioral scientist and Deming was the humanist. Some quotes to put your mindset into where I'm coming from. One can picture a good life by analyzing one's feelings, says the behavioral scientist, but one can achieve it only by arranging environmental contingencies. What's a contingency? If you do this, you will get this or avoid this. Skinner's legacy to us, three words: selection by consequences. We do what we do for the consequences we expect to get for doing it. And I'm telling you right now, a lot of the pop psychology stuff out there misses the power of consequences. Say you're the greatest and you can be the greatest, right? Say you can do it and you can do anything you want to do. They talk that way. Immediate consequences outweigh delayed consequences. You can relate to that. Now, Paul Chance, a scholar in the field, wrote an article, and he said, to save the world, we have to prove Skinner wrong with regard to this quote. I mean, if only immediate consequences keep us going in the safety world, we're in trouble, because we're preparing people for the potential, not real, but the possibility of a delayed consequence. Second quote, consequences for the individual usually outweigh consequences for others. And Paul Chance said, we can't save the world if we can't prove Skinner wrong. And I'm telling you right now, we don't have to prove Skinner wrong. Before we end today, you're going to walk out here realizing, wow, because helping people is a reinforcer. Helping people is the best thing you can do. I'll kind of skip ahead. Who remembers Maslow's hierarchy of needs in school? Okay, what's the top? Self-actualization. Oh, it's still in some of the books. Other books have realized their mistake after I wrote them letters. But we satisfy our physiological needs. Remember this? Then your safety and security. Then you move up and you got your social needs. And then you got your self-esteem. And then you've got your self-actualization. I asked my professor when I was a student, sir, what's that mean to be self-actualized? How will I know? Because I was a behavioral scientist strictly in those days, and don't teach me a concept if you can't tell me what I need to do to connect to that concept. And he says, well, Scott, let me tell you. When you're self-actualized, you believe you've done it all. You've made a difference in the world you wanted to make. You can sit back and say, I did it. And then he looked at me and he said, and Geller, I don't think you'll ever get there. And he was right. But you know what? That's not the top of Maslow's hierarchy. Abraham Maslow died in 1970 and he wrote his last book and his wife published it in 1971. Look it up. It's called The Farthest Reaches of Human Nature. He said he was wrong. The top of the ladder is self-transcendence. Going beyond yourself for somebody else. We call it actively caring. And here's the key. This is the bottom line of my whole talk today. How about teaching people how great it feels to help others, to stand by me? How great it would be if people realized the reinforcing power of helping. And you don't have to go through all these steps. Mother Teresa didn't. Gandhi didn't. Many people, they're helping people in Houston and Florida, and they haven't even eaten. They haven't gotten all these steps, but they're going to the top. And how you watch their interviews, and they feel great. They feel great. But that's reactive. We need proactive, actively caring. Don't blame people for problems created by the system. There's Deming. Well, he rocked my boat when I heard him give a four-day workshop in Cincinnati in 1991, and Deming was 91. He He blew me away. He was not a clear speaker because he had suffered a stroke. But what he had to say was so moving. I took 70 pages of notes. And he wrote with a grease pen on the overhead projector. I put my notes together in a set of overheads. I told you I use overheads. And I sent them to him for his next presentation. That year, 1991, I introduced him to the American Psychological Association. Highlight of my career. If you guys don't know the name W. Edwards Deming, who might not know the name? He's the guy who's given credit for turning Japan around in the 50s. We were fat cats. We didn't need some of the principles that Deming taught, but Japan did. They now, to this day, every year they have a Deming Prize, the company that shows the greatest increase in total quality management gets a Deming Prize. So it's a big deal. And he rocked my boat. You can't measure everything. Well, are you kidding me? I'm a behavior scientist. If you can't manage it, you can't manage it. You can still be a leader. Sometimes you just do it because it's the right thing to do. A numerical goal without a method is nonsense. Deming would say at least three times during his, what could be worse? Goal without method. Goal without method. We set goals, but we don't teach people. Or we set visions or targets, but we don't teach people how to get there. Talk about distress. Talk about, by the way, stress is okay. Distress is bad. And the difference is the perception of control. So if you set people up with things to do to make it happen, and you teach them that it's stress, and that's good. Look it up in the dictionary. It's not a negative word. It means pressure to get the job done. Distress means the lack of or the perception that you don't have control. So you set people up for distress. When you set up a goal or a vision and you don't teach them what to do to get there. Ranking people, teams, or divisions induces conflict, destroys morale, and prevents optimization. That was tough for me to accept. You mean he's talking about interdependency, not independent. You know, I always thought nice guys finish last. You got to blow your own horn. The squeaky wheel gets the grease. I mean, that's how I was raised. And Deming's saying, no, we have to work together. Someone wants to help me, I can do it myself. I became independent. And we have to move people from that independent state to interdependent. There, I told you that one. In God we trust, all others bring data. All right, I just want to introduce you to a book. Came out last year. I'm very proud of this book. It's 700 pages. And I'm proud of it because it's based on science. Notice the title, and it's published by Cambridge University Press, which in my field, that's like top of the line, because you just don't get anything published by Cambridge University unless you've got something to say. And I want to tell you this, some of you students, you've bought books. This book is $39.
Whoa.
$39. My students are paying $100+ for books with that many pages. Anyway, you can get it from Amazon. I wish I had to give away. I do have another book to give away. But let's talk about this one. Notice the subtitle, Actively Caring for People. And I just want to show you a little bit of the contents, and not to sell a book, but to kind of teach you where we're coming from. In fact, what I want you to get from this is that these seven lessons come from this book. That the seven lessons is the foundation. Okay, so I got a bunch of social influence, courage to actively care, motivation, intersection of actively caring and positive psychology. We'll talk a little bit about that. And leadership, followership, and AC4P behavior means actively caring for people behavior. So that's those are the principles. And then it goes into the applications. And I want you to check it out. Occupational safety at the top, traffic safety, alcohol abuse, obesity, patient-centered health care, children, parenting. I'm writing another book now on for parents. Preschoolers, young adults, higher education, actively caring for Mother Earth, for sustainability. My daughter wrote the last chapter. She got her PhD from Virginia Tech, and she wrote about how pets can be agents of actively caring for people. Okay, that said, this is the book I wish I had to give you, but it is available. It just came out this year. And it's, notice the title, Actively Caring for People's Safety. ASSE published it 4 months ago. And I used this book in our workshop yesterday. And let me just tell you, this is not a textbook. This is a manual. And I'm not supposed to sell stuff, although I went to a session not today where the person was showing videos or where they were showing off how other people love their company. I'm not selling a company. I'm selling knowledge. And this book is a manual to help you customize behavior-based safety for your organization. Enough said. We also have one for police officers. We have one for school teachers. We have one for college students. It's all the same life lessons that I'm going to share with you in a few moments. And then I've written two novels. And one of those novels, The Courage to Actively Care, I have 50 copies up here. I don't know how I can distribute the 50 copies fairly. Maybe Carolyn has an idea.
I'll think of it.
Think of an idea. I got 50 copies of this book right here. And by the way, if you ever got a book years ago called The Courage Factor, you know, this is the same book, only rewritten to reflect actively caring. And then there's another book, When No One's Watching. That was rewritten to reflect the motivation to actively care. But they're novels, meaning you read a story, and while you're reading a story, people learn. I must confess that I am frustrated. I'm a frustrated researcher because I've tried for years to get the word out, and it's not getting out there. Oh, the students read my textbooks, but the real people out like you who could make a difference in the world, it's not getting to you. And that's why I've tried a CD. I'm trying everything I can to try to get the message. I want to share with this what our former President Obama said. Using behavioral science, he's using our language to better serve the American people, encourages executive departments and federal agencies to apply behavioral science insights, test and evaluate the impact of these applications, recruit behavioral science experts to join the federal government, and strengthen agency relationships with the research community to better use empirical findings from behavioral science. I've been waiting 50 years for something like that. You kidding? Behavioral science insights can support a range of national priorities, including helping workers find better jobs, enabling Americans to lead longer, healthier lives, improving access to educational opportunities and support for success in school, and accelerating the transition to a low-carbon economy. Whatever you might think about our former president, he was a smart dude. He was a smart dude. He knew. Finally, this was written, by the way, September, about 2 years ago. The order made permanent, I wonder, the first ever White House Social and Behavioral Sciences team, a cross-agency group of experts in applied behavioral science. That's where this stuff comes from, plus humanism, that translates finding methods from the social and behavioral sciences into improvements in federal policies and programs. Wow, I had to share that with you because, like I said, I've been waiting to see this happen big time. Of course, it's not going to do anything beyond that if people don't get involved, engaged. All right, lesson number one. Now, by the way, this is not rocket science. In fact, I'm a little disappointed that this session was for intermediate. This session is for beginning, intermediate, and advanced. All levels. Are you kidding? But this is so basic. But if it's so basic, why don't we follow it? If you want to improve behavior and attitude at the same time, employ more positive consequences. The most efficient way to improve both behavior and attitude simultaneously. Positive consequences, and by the way, you know this, should be soon, frequent, and behavior-based. We know that. What is this strange and beautiful feeling inside of me? Waves of ecstasy are pulsing through my soul. This is why I only use positive reinforcement once a year. I'm all tingly. And by the way, positive reinforcement is used incorrectly by so many people. Watch your language. I said positive consequence. If the positive consequence does not increase the behavior it followed, it was not positive reinforcement. And the consequence was not a positive reinforcer. It's okay. We teach consequences. I could give you a positive consequence. In fact, you do this excellent job. You're at the peak performer today. And I give you sincere appreciation, a positive consequence. That may not have you do much better. You're already at peak performance. Do you still do it? Of course, because I'm concerned about feelings. I want you to feel competent and good at what you're doing. So it might not increase behavior, but it might improve an attitude, a feeling, a person's state. Alice, here's a bonus for your good work. On what? I can't be specific, because then you might do it again and expect another bonus. Congratulations, you motivated me to act randomly. I'm going over here and I don't know why. Again, we don't follow the basic principle of soon specific. I try not to let it bother me, says Snoopy, but I just can't help it. I've never been chosen employee of the month. We used to do that. Maybe some companies still do. They set one person up to be the best. 600 losers and one winner. Years ago, I'm kidding you. Some of you know this, right? I kid you not. They would put a snowmobile right in the workplace. And there'd be a big sign, every time you go a day without an injury, you get a coupon for the drawing at the end of the month for the snowmobile. Seriously, maybe it wasn't a TV set or something. I mean, it's so wrong. And guess what? It's changed. In fact, we got OSHA to admit that that's not the way to go. And Ted gets a singular achievement award for creating the We Are Teams campaign. It's a check for $1,000. Let's all give Ted a hand. Slap, whack. These things never work out the way you want. One winner and many losers. We got married 20 years ago. I said, I love you. If anything changes, I'll let you know. Beware of the behavior you're rewarding. How often do we, well, we know that. Beware of, sometimes we reward people not to report an injury. I told you I'm writing a manual for parenting. It's probably the most important manual I've ever written. And here's a lesson. Oh, now will you please stop crying? How many parents reward a child to get them to stop doing something that's annoying? That's called negative reinforcement. Whenever you do something to avoid an aversive consequence, you are negatively reinforced. And the child is positively reinforced. Reward effort, not ability. This is so important. When I was growing up, I remember that some people would talk and they'd tell me, I'd hear them talk about, oh, my child is brilliant. He's a natural. She is just an amazing. She's a natural, with social skills. And research has been done since then to show how wrong that is. When you give people a label based on ability instead of behavior or effort, you give them a label they feel obligated to live up to. And it could be a bad label, by the way. But even a good label, you tell someone, and she's done, read a book she wrote called Mindset. And she, Carol Dweck, explains how, no, it's Mindset. That we have to reward effort over ability. Because what she showed is if you label a child smart, she labeled a whole bunch of kids smart after they took a test, said, you kids are brilliant. The other half of the kids, they were balanced for actual intelligence, were told, you really tried hard. You showed a lot of effort. And then she asked those two groups, here's a challenging task. Would you like to take it to see how well you do? Those given the ability label, no thank you. No thank you. Those given the effort label, yeah, because I'm motivated. Perfect routine, Susie, you're a natural. Awesome, now I don't have to practice. Again, the value of behavior-based safety or behavior-based consequences is that you base the consequences on what people are doing. Oh, let me go back. Positive consequences promote success seeking. Negative consequences promote failure avoiding. This chart right here is so important because I ask you the question, where do you fit? Are you a success seeker? Those are the optimists, by the way. Those are the ones who are more likely to be self-motivated. Those are the ones who are most likely to go beyond the call of duty, do more than they have to. Or are you a failure avoider? Just do enough so as not to avoid failure. Perhaps you say in yourself, it depends, doesn't it? It depends. If the way you keep score for safety is only about avoiding failure, people will become failure. When it comes to production, however, we're counting how much production they do, counting what are they doing to achieve how much better. So that's success seeker. I have 600 students in my intro class. The first day of class, I ask, how many are here to avoid failure? 500 raise their hand. And I said, I'm so sorry. What? I said, I'm sorry. I'm glad you're here, please. But you don't have the right mindset or attitude for this class. You probably told your friends, I got to go to class. Not I get to go to class. You probably woke up to an alarm clock, not an opportunity clock. How do you see it? As an opportunity to move forward, as or avoiding a negative consequence? Ready, get set. And I know coaches who think that's the way you coach. And I also know a lot of students who quit an athletic possibility for them in a sport in college and in high school because they had coaches who didn't connect from a positive perspective. It's always sit still, heal, never think, innovate, or be yourself. Now watch how these mice significantly increase their information processing, decision-making, and goal-directed behavior. See, what's interesting is the mice will change their behavior, and so will humans. You can threaten people to change their behavior, and the more severe the threat, the more likely will they do what you want. So it looks like it works. Pass a law and enforce it. That's a government approach to managing behavior. And it feels like it works. But it's temporary. If the coach is not around to hold them accountable. Sometimes people do the opposite to assert their freedom when they can. I heard you remove the label. When I was a little kid, I saw that label under my mattress. And I looked around, I closed my bedroom door. Make sure no one is around. And I went over and I ripped the label out. I felt so good. Skinner called it counter control. Jack Brehm calls it psychological reactance. We assert our freedom. Picture. But the sign says only shirt and shoes required. We just do enough. No more. And it feels good. It feels good to beat the system. It's freedom. It's individualism. It's our culture. You have to understand what an intrinsic positive consequence is. It's not inside you, but you experience it every day. I tell my students, I said, you know, you got to stop texting while you're driving. But I understand it. It's not an addiction. It's a Skinner box, meaning it's intrinsic reinforcement. You have this machine in your hand, and you're punching buttons, and you get an immediate consequence, natural consequence. Just like these individuals doing the puzzle, they get a natural consequence connected directly to the behavior. That's the most powerful consequence. And guess what? Now I can say reinforcer. Now I can say intrinsic reinforcement, because I know that those natural consequences increase the occurrence of the behavior. That's correct, Billy, but you don't win a prize this time. See, Billy expects an extrinsic consequence. Now, there's nothing wrong with extrinsic consequences. Really, as long as they're delivered as a token of appreciation, not a payoff. And I actually hear incentive programs talking about giving people rewards for doing things for safety. And I say, okay, but how are you delivering it? It's a token of my appreciation. It's not a payoff. In fact, look, the big reward for Billy should be you solve the problem. That's what's intrinsic. That's what's connected to the task. And that's what's important. So when you start giving out rewards for safety behavior, beautiful. But be sure you deliver it appropriately. This is a token of appreciation for your safety leadership, because the real consequence that you're doing is you're preventing an injury, saving a life. What are you guys doing? this guy's totally into the extrinsic monetary I'm land block. But this guy has another vision. It's like, it's about safety. It's about you people are helping people. I'm on a team building a community center. They're both anticipated consequences, but this is bigger and more important. And that's why I hope you guys get up every day, and gals, get up every day and you talk to yourself about how important your job is. Because I know you don't get enough positive consequences from the people around you. So you have to reinforce yourself. And you have to say, this is not just getting people to wear their PPE. This is not just filling out forms. This is about keeping people safe. This is about cultivating a brother, sisters, keeper program, culture. Okay, lesson two. We all know this, observational learning. If you want to be better at what you do, observe someone who's better than you. Well, where'd you learn to drive so fast, young lady? I mean, the kids watch us, man, and they listen to us. Move over, stupid. Make up your mind. Jeffrey, what are you doing driving like daddy? People watch. Even animals watch. How about this? The eye's a better teacher and more willing than the ear. Find counsel is confusing, but example's always clear. And the best of all the preachers are the ones who live their creed. For to see the good in action is what everybody needs. I can soon learn how to do it if you let me see it done. I could watch your hands in action, though your tongue too fast may run. And the lectures you deliver may be very wise and true, but I'd rather get my lesson by watching what you do. For I may not understand you in the fine advice you give. There's no misunderstanding how you act and how you live. How many buy that? Thumbs up? Come on, just give me a thumbs up. Participate. Thumbs up. Come on, show me. Show me. I believe in observational learning. Take that thumb, put it on your chin. Some of you heard it, but you knew. But I saw people kind of hesitating. This is your chink. And by the way, I use lesson two when I talk to people about why I want them to do what they're doing. Hey, I know you don't think it's going to happen to you. I know that you text message while you drive, and you're a safe driver. If you ask a group of people who thinks that they're safer than all the other drivers on the road, than most of the other drivers on the road, raise your hand. When I ask my students that, they're 18 and 20, 19, they all raise their hand, man. They actually believe, you know. So I know you don't think you're going to be in a crash. But how about this? You're setting an example. Whether it's text message or what's going on in a workplace, you're going down the stairs, you're not holding the handrail. People are seeing that. I have students at my university walking down the stairs and texting while they're walking. And they walk slower because they're compensating, and then there's a line of people behind them. How do I talk to them? What do I say? Hey, can I look out for your safety? Can I actively care for your safety? John Drevinger, my buddy, says, as you know, see, you start out by, as you know, it is best to use a handrail. Can I look out for your safety? Yeah, foot in the door. When they say yes, and who's going to say no to that? Then you give them your safety advice. But the deal is, why? I'm not going to trip and fall, but how many people see you doing what you're doing? And they think it's the right thing to do. And if everybody texts while they drive, will there be another crash on the highway? Of course. All right. There's a dog. He's got a problem. And so the dad, he's going to model with the dog. And look at the dog now. It works. Lesson three. Hey, this is such a powerful lesson, and we know this. And this, by the way, is behavior-based safety. And I'm telling you, the data is there. The data is there. We reduced injuries, and we saved lives with behavior-based safety when it's done right. And it is about feedback. Distinguish between feed-forward, however, and feedback. What do I mean? Check out the diagram. We have an activator preceding the behavior. We have a consequence following the behavior. It has to go through the person, of course, who might interpret the activator differently. But notice, if this activator comes before the behavior, we call it feed forward. Direction. A seminar. Something we assign. Feed forward. If it comes after the behavior, it's a consequence, and we call it feedback. Make feedback sincere, specific, soon, and significant. Specify the desired behavior. Of course, you know that. When you give someone feedback, you specify the behavior. Well, at least I know you're not cheating. And that's not what I mean. That's not what I mean. I want you to become a behavior-based feed-forward and feedback coach. This is the essence of behavior-based safety, along with the other principles we're talking about here today. But before I go there, the word feedback has negative connotations, doesn't it? Your supervisors come to you and say, can I give you some feedback? Come to my office. At the end of the day, has your day been ruined? Because feedback has not been used enough as a positive consequence. There is supportive feedback, and there is corrective feedback. We need both. But there needs to be more supportive than corrective. Well, that's delayed feedback. That's not going to work. And this is delayed. Please, dear customer, please disregard this feedback if your check is in the mail. I mean, no, sorry. But I want you to understand what the letters of coach mean. I can sum up behavior-based safety with these letters in the order in which we start with care. Know that I care, you'll care what I know. That's why we're here. That's why we're doing it. Because we care about you. I care so much, I'm willing to observe you. That's the only way to improve, to watch you. And by the way, you can watch me. It's reciprocal. But now it's my turn to watch you. And I've got a checklist that we've prepared together. And by the way, we've looked for the exposures that are most likely to lead to a more aversive injury, a more severe injury. And by the way, while I'm observing you, I'm analyzing. I'm looking around to see what factors in the environment might be influencing that behavior. Is something facilitating at-risk behavior? Is there a lack of facilitation of safe behavior? What might we talk about that we could change? That's the comment section of a feedback sheet, which I think often is left blank because the engineers... How many engineers? I'll slow it down. I didn't mean that. It just slipped. It's a habit. By the way, that's another mistake. Have you ever heard people say safety should be a habit? How many heard that? Should be habitual? No. How many buckle up out of habit? No, you don't. Talk to yourself. I'll explain more later in a minute. I analyze. And then I communicate. And let me tell you something about communication. So the number crunchers, they just want the numbers, and they put in a computer program, and then they have data, and they have percent safe. Let me tell you, you think that data is reliable? You think that data is valid? Of course it's not. It's so biased, it's ridiculous. But it's okay, because the data, it's an approximation, but it's not about the data. It's about the communication. It's about that interaction. It's about brothers, sisters, keepers. It's about actively caring for each other. And the communication needs to be humanistic. Now we're getting to human. It needs to be non-directive. This is the piece of behavior-based safety that is missing in so many programs out there. They don't do this. And they don't even do this. They just get their checklist filled out, put it on a computer program, and they get the numbers. That's not what it is. No wonder that doesn't work. It's better than nothing. A little bit. But this is the human part. And I say non-directive. I mean, when you're non-directive, you ask more questions than you give direction. Hey, this is the data. This is what I saw. What do you think? What do you see? Is this the safest way to do this job? Have I, the observer, missed something? Get that person to own up and say, yeah, I know, I was in a hurry. I was in a hurry and I wasn't thinking. You get them to own up and you get someone to apologize. Now, that's big. I'm sorry. But you won't get that to happen if you're directive. You get ownership if they're non-directive. Then you're going to help. Then you'll help. Oh, yeah. This is the part I want to show you. That's a ticket I got. Yeah, not too long ago. Here, I'm going to blow it up. And I'm going to highlight. Yeah. Can you believe? I've promoted safety belt use. I don't even say seat belt. All my life, man. I mean, since the 80s. I set up programs in our Blacksburg community to get people to buckle up. And this officer pulled me over. I got my dog with me because I had to drop him off somewhere. And he pulled me over. And I said, sir, was I speeding? And he said, I'm not getting you for speeding. You're not wearing your seatbelt. I looked over. I couldn't believe it. I look over. No, I wasn't wearing my seat. I told my daughter about that, and she said, and she works for Bechtel. And she said, Dad, that's exactly why we need observation and feedback. Because people think they know. You, of all people, getting caught not wearing a safety belt. In fact, I went back to the officer while he's filling out my ticket. I said, sir, I understand, but I just want you to know, that's not me. I mean, and in fact, I don't even use the word seat belt. It's a safety belt. But the point is my daughter said, we need people. to look out for us. It's not a habit. If safety belt use were a habit, actually, a habit means you always do the same thing every time. No, it takes mindful. And that day, I wasn't thinking. I wasn't thinking when I got in the car. I can't even reflect how it happened. But it's why we need people looking out for each other. That's a hard lesson. But the positive part is somebody was looking out for me. And I needed that. And if you asked me if I needed someone to look out for my use of a safety belt in a vehicle, I'd laugh at him. No way, man. No way I always buckle up. It's a habit. I don't think so. You give more supportive than corrective feedback. Back to lesson one. What'd your supervisor say? I mean, again, the negative connotations of feedback. We do have a manual for police officers, and if we just redrew the cartoon for police officers, and I told you I'm writing a manual for parents, and that's the way we... Oh, we don't have that up here. I didn't have... Never mind. Lesson five. Empathy. Now I'm getting humanistic. We've been talking behavioral science. I'm getting humanistic. We have 30 minutes, huh? That's my former wife with a cone, and one of my students with a cone, and they are trying to have empathy for my dog who had to have that operation. And what it is, empathy is when you put yourself in the other person's position. You can't have it through email. Empathy requires an emotional connection. What do you mean I'm disconnected and out of touch? I have email, a smartphone, text messaging, Facebook, and Twitter. Yeah, and you're still out of touch. Empathic listening is special and rare. There's five levels of listening. At the very bottom, and the worst level, of course, is ignore. Have you ever felt ignored? Press one to be ignored, press two to be ignored longer. No one's paying attention. Sometimes we pretend. Thank you for pretending. Sometimes, this is most often, selective. Have you ever heard the term selective perception? That's redundant. All perception is selective. Sensation means we bring in, we see, we feel, we touch, but then we interpret it, and that's called perception. And it's always selective. No, honey, not I saw at a table. It's I have seen a table. Mom is not seeing it from the child's perspective. Ha-ha, Biff, guess what? After you go to the drugstore and the post office, I'm going to the vets to get tutored. No, he wasn't listening. And I've got attentive. Attentive listening. It's when you really try to bring it all in. But I'm telling you, that's not the best. The top is empathic listening. And you know what I like to do? I want to tell you my story. And some of you have heard this before, and I apologize for the redundancy, but I want to tell you about the Blue Book story. 1974 happened to me. I'm teaching a class, 400 students, introductory psychology. And they're all filling out the exams in a Blue Book. Remember? Anybody remember Blue Books? Oh, yeah. In those days, we gave them away. Now, 20 cents. You got to go buy the Blue Book to take the exam in the Blue Book. Anyway, this is 1974. Third exam of the semester. It started at 10 o'clock was the beginning. Just 50 minutes of writing answers. So now it's 10 to 11. I clap my hands, class. We're done. Bring your exams forward. And the students did. They came forward with their Blue Books. Except one dude in the back. He continued to write in his Blue Book. Sit as bold as could be, he's writing in his Blue Book. I'm watching him and I'm saying to myself, my selective perception, cheater. That's what I said to myself, cheater. Because he was cheating. It's now 11 o'clock and the students have left. And I'm collecting the Blue Books off the stage. And this kid comes running up, waving his Blue Book. Professor Geller. Please, don't forget my blue book. And I looked him square in the eyes and I said, keep it, son. He said, what? Keep your blue book. You cheated. This is not the first exam. It's the third exam. You know my rule. It's a cardinal rule. You don't take extra time. I grade on a curve and it wouldn't be fair to the rest of the class. Besides, you're a failure avoider, aren't you? You're working to avoid failure in this class. You're not working to achieve. You're not a success seeker. He said, I'm not sure I know what you mean, sir, but my mother will kill me if I flunk psychology. That's what I mean. You're not here for your mom. You're here for you. I can't take your blue book. He tried one more time. He said, sir, what if I just erased everything I wrote in the last 10 minutes? Wouldn't that be fair? Yeah, I said, it'd be fair if I trusted you. Will you try to beat the system once or try to beat the system again? I don't trust you. I can't take your blue book. He was down. He took his blue book and he walked down this middle aisle of this large auditorium. Got about 30 feet from the door and he turned on his heels and he walked up to me with the air of confidence that I barely couldn't believe at the time. And he said, sir, do you know who I am? I said, son, no, there are 400 students in this class. I don't know who you are, and I don't rightly care. Good. Took his blue book, flew into the pile with all the rest, ran to the back of the classroom. And whose side are you on? Whose side are you on? By the way, how many heard that before? Not from me, but from somebody else. It's been on the internet. Johnny Carson, he preceded Jay Leno, who preceded Jimmy Fallon on The Tonight Show. He told my story. He's that professor in Virginia. I don't know how he got it, but he told my story. And my daughter saw this story in a movie called The Slackers. In the beginning, they show this story. She said, Dad, they got your story in a movie. Her next word was, sue them. Isn't that American, huh? Sue them. But that's not the whole story. The whole story has a lesson. He's running out of the classroom thinking he beat the system, and I run over to the stage and I see his blue book. I was fast in those days and my eyes were working. That's 74, man. That's a long time ago. I know who he is. I got his name. What would you do? What would you do? Cardinal rule? Broke a cardinal rule. What would you do? How many would flunk him? What? One, two people. Okay, three. See, we're getting a little bit of conformity going, huh? Anybody else would flunk him? What are the rest of you thinking? What are you thinking? Now, I couldn't wait to flunk him. Oh, are you kidding me? Big smile on my face. Whoa. He thought he'd be, I'll show him who's the manager of this classroom. But it's a 10-minute walk back to my office. And I was thinking, perhaps what some of you are thinking, what a top-down, one-way conversation I just had. I'm imagining going and opening up the drawer, we didn't have computers, and pulling it, looking for his name, and putting a big F, and then it hit me. Wait a minute. What kind of a conversation was that? I have no idea where he was coming from. In fact, it occurred to me that he sat back there so bold, sitting up there and writing. That's not a typical cheater. They have little coofers in their pocket. No, he was, maybe he didn't think he was cheating. Is that possible? That by the way, the humanists focus on intention. Intention. You see two people fighting and the behaviorists would say, that's aggressive behavior. And the humanists would say, maybe not. Maybe they're playing. Maybe it's horseplay. Have you ever horseplayed and eventually get a little pain and it turned into real aggression? What changed? The behavior is the same. The intention. and I have no idea what his intentions. It's also possible that he didn't know the exam was over. Is it possible that I called for the end of the exam and he was so engaged, there's that word again, engaged, that he didn't hear it? Is that possible? Yes. It's not probable, though. 400 students, but it's possible. And I didn't consider that. I walked back to my office thinking, what a jerk I am. What a lesson I learned that day. By the way, he got an A- on that exam. His next exam was the final exam. He got an A. And an A in the course, A- in the course, actually. And he majored in psychology. He majored in psychology. Is it possible that if I had flunked him that day, from his perspective, totally unfair, that he might not even have majored in psychology? One interaction between a supervisor, between a teacher, one interaction can turn you off. You might have become an engineer, made more money. That's how I learned about empathy, the hard way. About sometimes you have to try to put yourself in the other person's shoes and be humanistic before you act. There's the beggar. He's empathic. He's got a hat for the lady. He's acting on behalf of the other person. Number six, customize consequences for self-direction. What if we could just get people to be more self-directed, to more self-motivated? So activate behavior with empowerment. I don't have anything more important to teach you today than right here. What does it mean to feel empowered? To feel empowered. Oh, the management definition of empowerment is giving you more to do with fewer resources. I empower you. Get it done. But do you feel empowered? Do you feel self-motivated? From social learning theory, Albert Bandura, I would ask three questions. You should ask three questions. Number one, can you do it? That's training. Do you know what to do? Never mind why, just go fetch. So knowing what to do might not be enough. I got a second question. It's called response efficacy. Notice the word self. Do I believe I can do it? You might believe that person can do it. But the person has to believe that he or she can do it. And response efficacy means, do you believe it will work? That this behavioral coaching process, or whatever process you're teaching people to feel empowered about, do you believe it will work? And by the way, that takes some education. That takes some education. Is there a difference between training and education? In elementary school, we educate. High school, we educate. College, we call it higher education. Then you go to the workplace, you call it training. Training department. Is there a difference? Yeah, you know the difference. Do you want your kids to get sex education or sex training? And if you ask your kids, give me the training, Dad, I want the training. And by the way, so I have a training question, education question, motivational question. Ah, this is the consequence question. Is it worth it? All the stuff we're asking people to do, is it worth it? Are the consequences worth the effort? How do you do that? With safety, it's tough. This is our toughest question as safety professionals. This is tough. No, for 10 consecutive years at this conference, I got to speak after Charlie Moorcraft. Anybody go to our talk, Charlie Moorcraft? And he was, how great, man. He was so great. I miss not doing that with him this year. But he would talk to the audience about his injury in such a dynamic way. And he would confess it was his fault. He didn't do the right thing. But he would get the audience, 3,000, they added up, we over 10 years, it was over 100,000 people that we got to address. And sometimes the same people, but they were sitting at the edge of their seats during his talk. Teary-eyed, emotional. That's the word I want you to get right here. Emotion. Emotion is motivating. And then he would say after he was done, He would say, okay, that's why. Now Geller will tell you how. I was so proud to do that because then I would have an hour. Sometimes he gave me an hour, sometimes a little less, but I got to talk about it. What do you do about it? Self-efficacy and response efficacy. But this was a critical one. So here's my point. Can you get people in your culture to stand up and talk about their injury? Can you get people to do that? Can you get people to talk about their close call and then discuss the contributing factors to that close call? Maybe that will get people emotional. Wow, I almost got it today. Can I talk to you about this? I mean, that's the kind of culture we want, because that will motivate brothers, sisters, keeper. That'll motivate us to want to look out for each other. But people need to speak up. And I'll ask you that question. In our book, we ask that question. And we say you should have a discussion about this. What would it take to get people to talk about their close calls, their injuries? Empowerment activates goal commitment. Let me just put this one up. SMART goals. You all heard about SMART goals? I've maybe changed it a little bit. What's the S? What's the M? Yeah, you're saying measurable. Thank you, Zig Ziglar. But I'm saying the M stands for motivational. And when you show the word motivational to me, it clicks. You know what clicks? One word. Please. Consequences. Consequences. Don't set a goal unless you realize what consequences you're going to achieve or avoid by achieving that goal. Then I got achievable and I got relevant. Notice, motivational means it's worth it. Achievable means it will work. No, achievable means I can do it. Relevant means it will work. So SMART goals are empowering. T is trackable. That's why I don't need M for measurable, because if I can track it, I can certainly measure it. And then I add an S, because I want you to share your goal with other people. That's empowering goal setting. But here's the key. I said it 3 times already. Consequences. Check out this diagram. You got your vision? Maybe it's 0 injuries. Now you feel empowered and you set your goals. I had a pop psychologist once said, vision alone is only dreaming. Goal setting without vision is just marking time. But put them together and you'll get behavior. And I say, not enough. Not enough. Because if you don't get consequences for that behavior, it will stop. If people don't see the consequences of their safety suggestion, don't expect more safety suggestions. You need a culture where people are constantly giving suggestions on ways to improve safety, to keep people safe. By the way, contingency management works. You want to demonstrate the power of consequences? Put a little sign on your table when you go out to eat next time. And the waitress will come over and say, what's that? Well, I don't give 20%. Depends on your behavior. If I'm pleased, you'll get an extra dollar. If I'm displeased, I'll take dollars away. You will get so much attention. You might have 3 or 4 servers coming over. I mean, telling you. But it demonstrates that, let's face it, contingency management, that means managing behavior through consequences. It works. Why aren't you wearing your safety glasses? I didn't see you coming. That's called other-directed behavior. It's better than nothing, but we need self-directed because we need self-motivation. Will he put on his hard hat? Maybe. Maybe if he's self-motivated, but there's no one around to hold him accountable, so he might not. The point is, how do we increase self-motivation? I'm telling you right now, I can't say anything more important than this. Research says, if you want to increase self-motivation, you need to increase perceptions of choice, competence, and community. And by the way, you've been there. You've been there. You know that when you feel you had some choice in this endeavor, you're more motivated. You know that when you feel competent at doing worthwhile work, you're more motivated to keep doing it. And you know that if you have a sense of relatedness connection to other people. There's so much more I could say about that. There's choice. Man, do we have this guy controlled. Every time we pull the lever, he gets the food pellet. What do I mean? It's reciprocal. I better hold back positive attention. Bobby's getting a big head. You know what? Spare the rod and spoil the child. I mean, we have such silly stuff out there that is totally wrong. I don't know anybody who's got a bigger head, big head, that holds them back because they got too much positive attention. But you feel good at what you're doing through attention and recognition, you'll keep doing it. I'd share my crackers with you, but I'm afraid I'd create a cycle of interdependency. That's exactly what we want. Teach your kids the notion of interdependent rather than independent. Some consequences fuel self-motivation. And I already said this, but by the way, I do have a TEDx talk. Has anybody seen my TEDx talk? Oh, God, thank you. I'm going to say I'm very proud of this. I'm soon going to hit 5 million views soon. It's been up for about 3 years. It's just 15 minutes. And let me recommend, I don't get any money for this, by the way. I get the pleasure of teaching people. Watch, show the TEDx talk. That TEDx talk reviews better than I just did for you. The principles of self-motivation. Show that TEDx talk to a work team and then say, okay, that's Geller and the university talk. Let's make it real. What can we do in our workplace to increase self-motivation? Because let me tell you, safety requires self-motivation. We can't be holding people accountable all day long. They have to hold themselves accountable. So you listen to the principles, show them the principles, and I've had several folks have done this. That's probably why it's almost 5 million. And then you have a discussion about it. As a teacher, that's my reinforcer. Last but not least is number 7. And I already told you this one, so we can go quickly. The hierarchy of needs suggests what consequences are motivating. So how do you know what consequences will motivate people? Depends where they are on the hierarchy of needs. Higher needs reflect self-motivation. What? We have a need called self-esteem and self-actualization. Gosh, if you fuel those needs, you're going to motivate me to be self-directed. Here they are, right? There they are. Remember, the top is self-actualization, but you know that's not true. That's the way we used to teach it. Some textbooks still have it there. I bet that's how you all learned it, if you remember. But it's wrong. The highest need is not about self. The highest need is self-transcendence. We call it actively caring for people. And some of you are wearing the wristband I gave you, and I appreciate that you've joined our movement. That's a movement. That's the actively caring for people movement. It's worldwide. It's fueled by win-win, interdependent mindset. Son, it's not whether you win or lose unless you want daddy's love. I mean, I fell into that trap. I coached Little League Baseball, and my daughter actually was a catcher. And I fell into that. I put the best players in because I wanted to win. And how about this? I mean, how much win-lose? Why does it have to be repeal and replace? Why can't it be refine and improve? Why do we always have to tear this group down before we can get our group? I'm sorry, but it's too bad. It's win-lose. And sometimes it happens in the workplace. We're all after the same thing. Self-transcendence is at the top. AC4 behavior is fueled by win-win interdependent. And now I want to just share with you that wristband. I got a little less than 10 minutes. I'm going to go quickly. There's Phil Zimbardo. He's wearing a wristband. So this show you that there are people out there wearing this wristband. Maybe you don't know Phil Zimbardo, but he's an important world guy in the academic world from Stanford. And there's Marty Seligman. He started positive psychology. He's wearing a wristband. There's Terry Bradshaw. Maybe some of you guys know him. He's wearing a wristband. There's Michelle Obama. She was given a wristband by the director of our VP of Human Student Affairs. She's wearing a wristband, and in her commencement address at our university, In 2012, she commended one of my students, Justin Graves, has committed himself to helping at least one person every single day. As he put it, life is all about what you have done for other people. He was in a wheelchair all his life, and he loved to help. He loved to hold the door open for other people. They're saying, you're holding the door open for me? And he loved it. And he was such a leader, is still such a leader in the movement. There's a Hokie bird wearing a wristband.
What about a West Virginia Mountaineer?
Oh, we got West Virginia. We beat him a few years. Yeah, it was close. You wearing a wristband?
No, I need one.
Carolyn gets a wristband because she introduced me so well, and she's supporting me. We're going to give out the books in a certain way, aren't we, in a minute?
Yes, we are.
I got to go quickly. This is a cadet. This is just a newspaper article. And this is, he's wearing a wristband. He's out of uniform. So it's gotten around in our culture. There's my student. We have a center for actively caring for people. We do research related to this whole deal. And my daughter just had a baby. And that's the generation. That's Harrison wearing a wristband. I don't have time to do this. I really don't. So let me move. Well, let me go back and show you that the wristbands have their own identification number. It's just not a wristband with a message. It has a number on it. And by the way, I have a blue wristband. Those are for police officers. So police officers in three different states are wearing blue wristbands with their own number. They have their own website, ac4ppolicing.org. Check it out. And if a police officer sees a citizen showing an act of kindness, going helping somebody, they take the wristband off their wrist. This is called community policing with a positive flavor, AC4P flavor, and they give them the wristband, and they have them join the movement. It's happening. We have a book, as I showed you earlier, to train police officers. And if any of you have any connection with police officers, write to me, and I will send you that book and a blue wristband, because we need to get this out there. It is about making the world a better place. It's see, act, pass, share. See somebody doing an act of kindness. Thank them. Give them the wristband. But tell them, you don't keep the wristband. I've given you a wristband for sitting here for an hour and a half. Wow. You sat through and you showed like you were really paying attention. I thank you. Now you got a wristband, but you don't keep it. Look for an act of kindness. Maybe even at this conference and take it off and give them the wristband and explain the movement. And then they can share it. They can go to the website and they can share their stories. AC4PCenter.org and share your story. It's worldwide. People have seen their wristband travel from the little town of Blacksburg to South Africa. And all of a sudden, people are seeing positive acts people are doing rather than all the negative news that we get. There's a blue wristband. I love this quote. History will have to record that the greatest tragedy of this period of social transition was not the strident clamor of the bad people, but the appalling silence of the good people. We're the good people. And we need to step up and show off what we know about the psychology of safety and about the movement. Notice he's wearing a wristband. And I want to end with a poem, and then we're going to give out the books, right? I want to end with a quick poem. It'll be quick. But I'm inspired by being here, and it brings this out of me. A tiger met a lion while drinking by the pool. Said the tiger to the lion, "Why you roar like such a fool?" "Roaring's not so foolish," said the lion with a twinkle in his eyes. "They call me the king of beasts, and it pays to advertise." A rabbit heard the lion and ran home like a streak. He thought he'd try the lion's trick, but his roar was just a squeak. So a hungry fox had his lunch in the woods. The moral of the story is, does not pay to advertise unless you've got the goods. That's why you're here at this conference, to get the goods so you continue to keep people safe. And I appreciate that, and I thank you for listening.
How is that for a fabulous presentation? Absolutely. So, as far as the books are concerned, I've passed around a little piece of paper. If you have a circle on your piece of paper, you are a fine winner of Dr. Geller's book. And I'll be up here, and I'm sure Dr. Geller will be taking questions here at the desk.